2002, I posted ads in theaters and acting schools in Los Angeles. And the ads were an open call for an actress who was blonde and in her mid-30s, who was medium height and medium weight. And from the many responses I got, this was the headshot of the girl I chose. And this is a work called Unknown. I photographed the actress in and around my house. And here she is playing my guitar in my living room. She's petting my cat. She's sitting outside. She's sitting on my bed. And these are very large-scale pastel drawings. Unknown was a project I did in direct response to a work I had just completed called Amy Adler Photographs Leonardo DiCaprio. And in this piece, I invited Leonardo DiCaprio to my apartment and photographed him. It took a year to arrange the meeting, but he showed up, and we had an intimate conversation while I photographed him by the light of my bedroom window. It's true. It happened. I prepared for the photo shoot by asking friends of mine to stand in that same position by the window, so it was really intense to suddenly see this actor through the same lens. And I made life-size drawings of the photographs, and then I destroyed the original photographs. And then once the drawings were made, I photographed them and destroyed the original drawings. I was trying to understand what life drawing was. So this piece was an attempt to stand face-to-face with someone that I would only ever be able to see through film. I'm including this here because the same year that I photographed Leonardo DiCaprio, I collaborated with recording artist Joni Mitchell. And this project was called Amy Adler Curates Joni Mitchell. And as you probably all know, Joni Mitchell is a painter as well as a singer. And but her paintings really only exist in the context of her music, on her record covers and her CD liners. So I was curious to see what would happen if I removed the paintings from the music, which I saw as working as a kind of chaperone or bodyguard. So with her consent, I borrowed a dozen of her paintings and showed them in an art gallery in Los Angeles. And the title of this album and this painting, which was painted by Joni Mitchell, was Both Sides Now. And it was this painting was in my show just weeks before it appeared on the cover of her record. In this older piece, it's called Bop. I sent in a drawing to the P.S. I Love You section of Bop magazine. And it's where lovesick teeny boppers send in their drawings of their beloved idols. And they publish it, which is... and I was not a teeny bopper. I mean, I was 25 years old. And it was among the highlights of my life. But I realized through the drawing that I could be a ventriloquist or a spy, an infiltrator or an imposter. And so here I'm a teenager. Here I'm a stranger, a man approaching a 13-year-old girl on the beach. But I'm also the girl, as these pictures were taken of me when I was 13. And the piece is called What Happened to Amy? I made these drawings over a six-month period of time, knowing that in the end they all had to rest in the supposed space of a single afternoon. By By standing in the position of the observed, I'm allowing the position of the observer and the observed to be flexible, meaning I, Amy, am not locked into a particular identity as a photographer, nor as a subject. I can come and go as I choose. Thank you very much. The five canvases on view downstairs are based on gay porn video box covers shot by photographer Jeff Burton. This video starred Chase Hunter, and the video was called The Chase is On. This piece is called Jeff Burton Box Covers, and Jeff and I collaborated on this project in the sense that he gave me his consent to draw these photographs. By giving me his consent, it's as though, through the drawing of the pictures, I'm invited onto the set, a place I, as a girl, would otherwise not likely find myself in. In other words, here I am a gay man. Anyway, this is Steve Rambo. I've worked a lot with found images, so the fact that Jeff gave me his consent made this a unique position for me to stand in. And the drawings downstairs are pastel drawings on canvas, and they're very fragile. So please don't touch them. As much as you may want to. I imagine the stage these boys stand on is rather fleeting as well. The same is true for this piece, which is a detail from a work entitled Different Girls. I chose a handful of girls that occupied a similar place in popular culture over the period of 1 year. And that would be also a fragile position that would shift. And these were based on 12 found images from different contexts, from videos and television, magazines and music and sports. And they called the piece Different Girls, as I didn't have their consent to name them. So again, by my drawing them, an intermediate space is created where it becomes unclear who exactly is watching and who is the performer. Thank you.
One of the things that I would like to reframe under this particular encounter is that it is said in the introduction to this show that I am the father of hacktivism. That is completely wrong. The mothers and fathers of hacktivism are a multitude, and it is a multitude that indeed has names, networks, and singularities. And I would like to touch base on a couple of those. Among the first names of hacktivism, electronic civil disobedience, is Critical Art Ensemble, of which I was a member of in the mid-80s through mid-90s. It was with them that we developed electronic civil disobedience theory and practice. Long before there was computers, we had stolen the words of Thoreau of 1848 on civil disobedience and just cut and paste electronic in front of that, and that created a whole wave of conceptual work. Following that was an encounter with Blast Five, another member who's not here, Jordan Crandall. I've never worked alone, so that is important to know. Another founding mother and father of hacktivism is The Thing, Thing.net, started by Wolfgang Stehle, conceptual artist and internet pioneer. We started in 1991 and have a total of six nodes throughout the world. The Zapatistas are certainly the mothers and fathers of contemporary hacktivism. And there is FakeShop.com, a group of simulation in Williamsburg, in New York that I worked with. And then there's the Electronic Disturbance Theater, the mother and father of electronic civil disobedience and practice, of which one of the members is also here, Brett Stahlbaum, who will be presenting later. So I just wanted to clarify that I am not the father of hacktivism. It is a multitude. And this multitude, I am known as the godfather of hacktivism. So it's a very different thing. One of the pieces that I'll present is a self-portrait. I haven't seen this piece, and neither has my collaborator, Caleb Waldorf. It's basically a map of everything and every group and every artist and artivist and hacktivist and media lab and hackers and digital zapatistas that I've worked with around the world. I always collaborate, and this is a self-portrait that is a map. It's being put up even as we speak, so I don't know. Hopefully Caleb won't faint. Caleb is an artist in MFA here. And there is an ugly kind of little picture of a very beautiful large-scale reproduction that we'll see. I started work originally with Critical Art Ensemble in Tallahassee, Florida. One of my areas of investigation was what I call micro-gestures within exit culture. And I would set up mimes at the edges of entrances of mall, Disney World, Burger King's, and I would play the soundtrack from Weekend by Godard when everybody's crashing and honking. And I would just start playing with my toys, and people would gather around, and they would start saying, well, this is a Vietnam vet, a lost individual, all sorts of things. And usually the police would arrive in a few minutes and try to arrest me, and there would usually be a dialogue between the community as to whether they should take me away or not. I would never say anything. And I always enjoyed the idea of micro-gestures, small gestures that disturb the social space and create a dialogue a la Theater of the Oppressed of Augusto Boal. Some of the collaborative trajectories of which I have interfaced with are electronic civil disobedience, digital zapatismo, or digital zapatistas, the Italian Net Strikes, Anonymous Digital Coalition of Italy, certainly one of the mothers and fathers of electronic civil disobedience, electronic disturbance theater, FloodNet, the virtual sit-in tool developed by net artist Brett Stahlbaum that we'll hear a bit later, and Carmen Karasik, the first automated virtual sit-in tool. This created the ability of a mass nonviolent direct action online of the unbearable weight of data bodies and real bodies saying, yeah, basta, to neoconservatism and neoliberalism as it expanded under the free trade movement of globalization. We did actions against the Mexican government of Cedillo, of Fox, against the Pentagon, against European companies that wanted to buy the rights to uranium in Chiapas. And we even had some strange informatic wars with the Pentagon. And we were later asked by the NSA to come and do a performance for them. An interesting space. Some of the elements that came out of this was artivism, digitally incorrect actions, and certainly we would fall into that. And we'd also work with hacktivists or digitally correct action, like Cult of the Dead Cow and Chaos Computer Club in Germany. So those are just some of the kind of collaborative trajectories that you can pop into the work. One of the most important is Mayan technologies. It really annoyed the NSA that so much of the work that we had done was based on Mayan technologies. And by the end of the performance, they kept saying, you know, what the hell is Mayan technologies? They still don't know to this day. But this young woman that I'm speaking to does know. And this was at the Tate in London a couple of years ago for a series of performances called Live. This is a book that will never be published, I think, and they'll be available for you there at the gallery, called Hacktivism, Network Art Activism. There are the founding members, Carmen Karasik, Brett Stahlbaum, Stefan Ray, myself. These are some of the reviews we got. If the electronic disturbance theater wasn't illegal, it was certainly immoral, U.S. Defense Department. The most striking thing about the electronic disturbance theater is its potential as an unheard-of writing machine. It's literally dispatches from the future. That's from Style magazine. We get the best things. Here is a the copy of the book that you'll get is my editing along with Atsuko Miyawaki. It follows along Ibsen's road of closet drama like Brand and Peer Gynt. This is a closet book, if you will, never meant to be published, I think. Another piece that we will see here is partly commissioned by Insight this past year, turistafronterizo.net, that you can play online. And you'll also see an unauthorized installation that was put up at the Zapatista headquarters in Tijuana, Mexico, which I signed a paper that said I would not create any material installation for Insight. Only an immaterial, but I don't like just immateriality. And the basic core idea was that the computer in the installation game box would remain there at the media lab of the Zapatista headquarters. The piece that you see when you go in, that will be shown at Colectivo Feminista down in Tijuana, and then that computer will stay with the Colectivo Feminista. The game and installation was in collaboration with Coco Fusco and artist Arvin Orkney, Tristan Schoen, and Rob Cohen. Tristan and Rob are students here. This is some photographs there. The last piece is a work that I recently did, an improvisation that we'll see briefly with Adrian Jenick. It was for SpecFlick, or Speculative Distributed Cinema. It's actually made to be presented on an iPod video, part of a new distribution mode. So the bit that you'll see here is not the best way to do it, but you'll see it when you go in. Basically, the character is an individual who has signed a contract for 5 years to be inside UCSD's new R&D towers in 2030. He's a nano janitor. He cleans artificial matter rooms in the nanosystems and material fabrication labs. And everything is streamed constantly in the state. And basically, La Jolla has been destroyed by green goo. And now the university is in Tijuana. And so this is, you'll see a little bit of this.
Hijo, mano, qué hermoso. Man, look at those. ¿Qué? Oh, ese vato, no, you know, I don't know. I think all the protocols are fine. I think I've done the Oz map and it's good, I'm telling you. No, I want you to tell them that the THX protocol is clear. See, just tell them. Just sideload them, eh? Yeah, Vato, I'm sorry. Yeah, I know. You're new and I've been hard on you all night. I say, Vato, I'm sorry. It's just, you know, I remember, like, 2012, you know, when the whole thing, when she flower, you know, when... Yeah, you know, the green goo, it just, man, turned everything to pudding up into La Jolla, you know, there was nothing, green mash, verde, nada, you know. Hijo, man, I was so fucking scared. That's why, I was hard on you tonight, because, you know, you got to have these protocols right, and, you know, you got to keep things clean, and...
Well, it's really an amazing privilege to have carved a sort of a small space within the visual arts department. For somebody, in this case, I would consider a kind of architect or urbanist in exile coming here to be part of this amazing family of very strange people. I'm really really excited about being part of your community. In reality, it's interesting that after decades of being absent from the main institutions of knowledge, you could say, of representation and display, we are all drawn back to the city, yearning to recuperate it again as a possible site of experimentation. In a way, I think that that might be a part of a kind of collective sort of energy at this moment in our cultural institutions to really critique so far the way the city has been understood, in a sense, as a static repository of buildings, in a way. And really, in a way, try to find it as a more complex condition and really understanding its multiple realities, its multiple forces. So in a way, that has been very interesting to me in redefining my practice, primarily at a juncture like this between Tijuana and San Diego, a kind of geography of conflict. And that's, in fact, what inspired many of these images that you will see in the show today. A few years ago at Southern California Institute of Architecture, where I used to teach, I brought dozens of students of architecture from all over the continent, from Latin America, to come and understand the sort of condition of a double city at that time, LA, Latin America, Los Angeles, and in so doing really understand the dynamics and the conditions of Southern California in relationship to Tijuana. So students came from all over the place to document the kind of drama of these spaces, these leftover sort of marginal spaces of pieces of infrastructure, and of course the kind of impact of immigration in the transformation of the physical aspect of cities like Los Angeles. These images are in fact made of pieces, many pieces of Los Angeles, San Diego, and Tijuana. In a way, they became emblematic of a conversation we are trying to generate to look at the city as, again, a kind of more complex sort of force field whose thickness we were trying to really penetrate and understand, and to possibly extract the possibility, let's say, of architecture being more than just an object that is, again, statically set in a pedestal, which is a city. So the redefinition of our own practices when we really enter the problematics of policies, of the politics of development, the economics of development begins to be fundamental in our time, mainly when all of us have been very distant from the politics of making, again, our environment. So how, as an architect, how I thought, does one operate straddling back and forth between these two conditions at this juncture, again, between the strategies of the informal in Tijuana and the politics of zoning, let's say, of density in San Diego? Of course, it would imply a kind of entering or encroaching into an urbanism that wanted to go beyond the property line and maybe begin to critique in a certain way this environment. So I began to be inspired very much by the transformation of our own city in the last decades by non-conforming patterns of use, by non-conforming densities that have completely really transformed what was at one point after the war a very one-dimensional Levittown type of environment. What is the implication of this transformation for a lot of us as architects or practitioners within the city? It has been of a lot of inspiration. I've been working with nonprofit organizations in San Diego, particularly one in San Isidro called Casa Familiar, and we figured that we could not really talk about housing, for example, affordable housing, without talking about policies, the policies that were shaping that housing. So no advances in design or housing design could happen without advances in policy. So we crafted this sort of micro policy with Casa Familiar, where we proposed to the city of San Diego that the NGO in this very small community would end up becoming a facilitator of permits, a facilitator of microloans, also research the conditions of these non-conforming patterns of use and density, these illegal uses. One project that you will see in the exhibition engages this possibility now, having this micro-policy as a foundation for a particular housing project, and looks at a very small parcel, a very small lot, and tries to understand the kind of illegal, at times, non-conforming circulation patterns and micro-economies that occur in these abandoned alleys and these communities, and transforms this parcel into a kind of framework of multiple ways of using the space so that at times it becomes a market, or the NGO officiates sort of workshops with the community, or the whole site can be leased for a Sweet 16, let's say, party. But this notion that the whole site becomes really used, a kind of the notions of promiscuity, let's say, of space and program has been very important for a lot of these communities. So the project ended up being a layered condition of housing and the accommodation, or the framing of these microeconomies, let's say. The idea was that we wanted to challenge the very official zoning that in that particular parcel only would allow us to make three or to do three units of housing. We proposed to this project 12 units of housing, a community garden, the renovation renovation of a community, of a historic church into a community center, and offices for the nonprofit. So the idea that a kind of social sustainability would be the basis for a lot of these housing projects, that we needed to see housing as more than just an amount of units in a city like San Diego, but housing in relationship, let's say, to other things. So this condition of pairing ambiguity and open-endedness in terms of these micro-infrastructures, let's say, that could accommodate non-conforming uses and the specificity, of course, of housing really became the essence of the project. So infrastructures of ambiguity is what has been really compelling to notice in a city like Tijuana. No other place in the world we find some of the wealthiest, again, subdivisions in the United States, barely 20 minutes away from some of the most precarious and poorest settlements in Latin America. So noticing the strategies of invasion in Tijuana, and the idea that we could also encroach into this politics of the informal has been very compelling. So we have been proposing through this nonprofit that I've been working with in collaboration with some entities in Tijuana to produce a very minimal, again, maybe following what Ricardo was talking about in terms of the kind of micro gesture, this micro infrastructure that could serve or could be produced by a maquiladora with a very low technology, let's say, in Tijuana, and could serve as an intelligent hinge that could thread many of the precarious and the kind of improvisational strategies that people use to build their environments in Tijuana by actually utilizing the waste of San Diego. So this became a kind of temporal scaffold that through time mediates these conditions without obliterating them by allowing in a certain way to give a certain visual coherence, but primarily a structural solidity. And this ultimately became an issue, as you can notice, between San Diego and Tijuana, between bringing a bit of, let's say, chaos and multiplicity or kind of conditions of mixed use and density into our very one-dimensional environment in San Diego, but in Tijuana it's the other way around. Chaos is already a fundamental part of that sort of environment, and that kind of sense of promiscuity for us in Tijuana was the idea of how do we begin to kind of create a set of organizational strategies for some of those environments in terms of infrastructure. But this project, this next project, this is the last one, mediated across those two conditions by creating the possibility of this house to move from one city to another and actually appropriating a parking lot in San Diego. This is a pavilion for Insight, the last Insight, last year, occupying one of the most sacred parking lots of the city, you know, in Balboa Park, temporarily, and in so doing, opening up the potentiality of the appropriation again of the leftover. And the idea that public space in this case could be portable, what could really take advantage of some of the most expected, let's say, conditions. The house that you see there was planned or proposed to be transferred from San Diego to Tijuana at the end of the event to, again, enter or continue to really operate across these sort of flows of relationship between the two cities. That's it. Thank you very much.
I'm going to play you a little bit of video from one of the three works that we'll be screening in the gallery as part of this show. And this is called LAX and will be the premiere of a new work by the Bureau of Investor Technology. The three works that I've chosen to show in this exhibition represent a span of 11 years of production involved in producing work as the Bureau of Inverse Technology. These are the production of information products that service the information age, or so was the post-colon non-explanation that followed its incorporation, the incorporation of the Bureau of Inverse Technology in 1991 when it was incorporated in the Cayman Islands. The Bureau of Inverse Technology was a bureaucratic front that reproduced the anonymity of technology. Technology, of course, is a strange cultural object that scripts our collective action and certainly is collectively produced, but for which no one is actually accountable. Right? The diffusion of accountability is the strange and particular condition of the information age. And although there are names and personalities, you can't actually call somebody up and say, look, I really don't like the speller that's in my Microsoft Word things. Who do you blame? Who do you hold responsible? Right? It's you can't pin it on anyone. So when the Bureau was formed, there were many collectives, right? They're very different to the collectives or the collective practices that preceded it. In the 70s, they were concerned with the reification of singular authorship, particularly male heroes, and concerned to reveal the collective practices and forms of production of thought and actions and work. The corporate art of the 90s, as we call it, the various forms of collective practices, from eToy to Artie Mark to the Barbie Liberation Organization, to name just some of the organizations and for whom this particular institution and this particular department was critical in fostering and supporting. These corporate art organizations were variously concerned with avoiding accountability, right? Reproducing that diffuse condition of the information age. So corporate art has now changed again very differently, and you'll see that mapped out in the production, the three video productions in the gallery. I'd like to say a couple of words about all three of them, and the first of which, of course, was produced in 1995, The Suicide Box, which was a motion detection video system placed in the vicinity of the Golden Gate Bridge. It monitored the Golden Gate Bridge for vertical motion, and when there was any vertical events, it captured that to a permanent video record. Now, in doing that, of course, we collected the suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge and also forged a new form of corporate sponsorship, which we've called inverse sponsorship. That is the technological equipment used, the Silicon Graphics machines and the software, the custom software, we were allowed to use on the condition that we did not mention the name of the corporations involved. This is one example of the strange set of conditions that you enter in producing this work. That work in 1997 was included in a show called the Whitney Biennale, and as an anonymous bureaucratic piece, the curators put it in without talking to the artists. And I think it had a particular, a particularly interesting interpretive moment there, because it was art. The curators talked about the images of suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge as simulated footage of suicides off the Golden Gate Bridge. How they had decided it was simulated, because it was art, it was not real, it couldn't be true. The relationship between art and truth was called into question by who would produce that? Who, what bureaucratic organization would actually do that? So then the Bitplane that screened was launched 5 years later, which had which was footage that was filmed again from a twinky little 32-inch wingspan radio-controlled aeroplane that flew over the Silicon Valley, also examined a different condition. In flying over the famed Silicon Valley, it really revealed nothing, right? Although there are no camera zones and the bit plane flew through these no camera zones, it showed the banality of a metastasizing suburban corporate context of what is now the Silicon Valley as it transformed from a military and agricultural urban layout. But there was nothing to see. And in all the corporate contexts, all the information research contexts where you can't enter with a camera, the idea splayed out by the bureau, the Bitplane, is that, in fact, information is property. It can be owned. And if you go in there with a camera, you can steal it, right? Which is why, of course, it's illegal to. And I think that this is a very problematic
understanding, a very popular delusion, that information is a commodity that can be owned and exchanged, and that university contexts such as this, which depend on open sharing regimes of information, can and does play a critical role in rethinking what our technological future looks like. The final piece, the video, is this piece, LAX, which is part of a series of projects that document the civil liberties infringements that have gone on in the name of anti-terrorism. In this case, it was a two-hour ordeal involving 18 police, 15 United Airlines staff, and various other service workers because of the national emergency of wearing rollerblades in Grand Central Station. In LAX. And examines the sort of use of this extreme force for these slightly unusual behaviours, many of which are documented in a collection called the, and a web database called the Anti-Terror Line. So I think just in conclusion, as I try to cover this arc, this change of corporate art practice, of the collective work to produce complex technical artifacts that we call our technical culture, with which we recognize our contemporary times, has many important political questions. New interactive technologies present opportunities for social change. This visual arts department has played a critical role in fostering practices with strong political and conceptual rigor and playful engagement with the technical future. The capacity and influence of this department is unprecedented within a research university and any other university in this country, thanks to past and to current leadership. It's an honor to be included in this department, and there is no doubt in my mind that this is the most intellectually exciting art department in the US. But it's also a tremendous challenge to continue this tradition. Thank you.
Okay, the project I'm going to talk about tonight is the Rush Creek Wilderness Trail, which was recently completed December 27th and 28th. The URL is available there. What it is, you know, it's possibly the world's first computationally derived unofficial public wilderness trail. And it was discovered by a computer algorithm that I authored called a virtual hiker. And I'm going to go into a little bit of the history of virtual hikers when talking about C5 shortly. And in this case, there's no trail per se that's been constructed. It's a backcountry track that you can follow with the assistance of a GPS device or a global positioning device, like the one I'm wearing on my wrist. The technique is that the track log is computationally produced by the C5 Landscape Database API, which is a software project that I've been working on for the past couple of years. And the process is that once this track log has been produced, you take a data cable, something like this, and plug it into the computer and plug that into the GPS device and upload that data to the GPS device, which allows me to go into the actual landscape and follow the computationally derived path in place. So where is the trail located? It's located in northeastern California. It runs from US 395 north of Litchfield to near the Nevada border. And that's the process that I just referred to, uploading the data to your GPS device and using the GPS device to follow it. The history of virtual hikers is that, again, it's a feature of the C5 Landscape Database API. C5 Corporation is a large collaboration that I've been involved with since the middle 1990s, a large number of artists working on a variety of different projects. I'll talk about the C5 Landscape Initiative shortly. Some of the sort of key themes or concerns for C5 Corporation is exploring the virtual real axis and in our case, using geographic information systems. In fact, the C5 Landscape Database is a geographic information system that we produce sort of in a homespun way within our own collaboration. So that's one concern. Another concern is large data sets. One of the things that we discovered early on in working with the particular data sets that we're working with from the United States Geological Survey is that we wanted to be able to explore really, really large geographic areas, in this case, the entire state of California. So this gave us somewhere in the range of 320 million data points in a raster to process. So immediately we ran up against the problem of, you know, how to actually do the kind of data processing to search this data set that we had the desire to search with sort of desktop and workstation class computational machinery. So the problem of large data sets has actually been soothed to a great deal via support of my research here at UCSD by the San Diego Supercomputing Center, who have been helping us solve some of those problems. And then the art historical trajectory in which I would situate this work is in the history of walking works. I just brought a few examples unfairly to the people that I'm leaving out, of course. Richard Long, A Line Made by Walking, 1967. Richard Long is an artist who, you know, travels places, temporarily rearranges the environment to photograph it, and then returns the environment to its natural state, or allows it to return to its natural state by itself. Dominique Mézioud, you know, The Great Cleansing of the Rio Grande River, an ecofeminist piece, which is very well known, where essentially the context of the artwork and the artist as a walker was to walk the bed of the Rio Grande River and clean it up. So this brings me to the C5 Landscape Initiative projects. And I'm only going to talk about one project in the C5 Landscape Initiative due to time constraints, but it's actually a suite of projects that have been exhibited most recently at San Francisco Camera Work. I'm going to talk about the Other Path project. So, and the reason I'm talking about this is the project that instigated research into virtual hikers. The original concept was to, which was sort of one of C5's obsessions for about a two-year period, was to find the Great Wall of California, or in other words, the Great Wall of China, where it should be located in California if it was moved, in the most topographically similar locations. So the data set that we're using, the digital elevation model data set, was processed through the C5 Landscape Database API in order to discover where in California the Great Wall of China should go. The process is, my colleague, who is also the project leader in this case, Jerry Wittig, who's an MFA from the Cadre Digital Media Lab, traveled to China to hike iconic sections of the Great Wall of China in order to collect, with a GPS device, a representative sample of that landscape. We brought that data back, inferred the topographical conditions in those areas, and then did the database search to find the locations in California where those locations of the Great Wall should go through our own software. So the virtual hikers come in and as part of the project, pattern matching search procedures, where we found the locations in California that were most similar to the locations in China where the Great Wall of China was, and then we traveled to those locations as C5. You can see in this image the other Mutanyu. I'm not pronouncing that correctly at all. But that's the location of this particular iconic section, of the Great Wall. And where, so on the left side you see this iconic section of the Great Wall of China. On the right side you see the location in California where that iconic section of the Great Wall should go. And part of the process is then for C5 to travel to those locations and follow the path of the Great Wall. So in a sense, it's performance through walking dictated by computation, and again playing with ideas of the virtual and the real, and the intersection of the virtual in really quite a literal way with the real to produce walking works. And so the real work in this case, I think the if you're going to identify an art object in this case, it's the hike itself. It's the experience that you have in the landscape with the GPS device on following the path. Nevertheless, as artists, you know, there's a responsibility to sort of create ways to describe this to the public through multiple interfaces. This is from the exhibition for this piece, which is two large etched glass panels with the topography of California and China embedded in the glass through a laser etching process with projections on them. And the projections demonstrated in this case both the algorithm, the process of the algorithm, you know, snips from the actual adventures in each of these locations, and a demonstration of some other information was presented in there, projected onto these two glass panels for the gallery installation. So these are some highlights then of the Rush Creek Trail. This is Stony Creek. And so, again, to sort of reiterate, what happened in this case was an algorithm discovered a path that was followed through the landscape. And I show this image simply because the virtual hiker found a path along the top of this canyon rim here. And instead of descending into the canyon, it actually found a way along the top of the canyon that was relatively easy to hike. Here's the trailhead, which was very much arbitrarily selected by myself. This is on a basaltic volcanic lava flow. So this is where the trail begins. And basically what you're going to see in the gallery tonight is an interpretive sign that you know, simulates the sort of semiotics of the typical kind of wilderness trailhead sign that you would see, that it also has these highlights on it. So you can read the descriptions of that. I'll just cover a couple of the highlights. This is a small intermittent waterfall near the rim of the canyon that the virtual hiker decided to walk past, and that I, following the virtual hiker, had the pleasure of seeing. This is the mouth of Stony Creek. The Rush Creek Wilderness Trail rises up out of the Stony Creek drainage and up over this watershed. So this is the area, just a photograph from the spot, where you can look in both directions. You can look back toward Stony Creek, and you can look ahead toward the Rush Creek drainage where the virtual hiker is leading you. This was a really interesting artifact of the algorithm. So what part of what's documented in the trail map that you'll see up in the gallery are not only kind of interesting spots along the trail that I took the liberty of naming, but also interesting areas along the trail where artifacts of the algorithm produced something that I thought was interesting. In this case, whereas it would have been easier for the virtual hiker to go around this particular hill, for some reason it chose to go up over the hill, and it yielded this. It's, you know, I'm not making any claims about intentionality of the software, but it was nice. It yielded sort of a nice view of this unnamed draw that's on was on the other side of the hill that drains into the Rush Creek Canyon. This was another computational artifact, and I will wrap up. This is another computational artifact, which were switchbacks. That actually weren't necessary to follow as switchbacks that eventually led into the Rush Creek Spring area. So this is phase one. Phase two of the trail will be open to the public just as soon as I've hiked it. And for now, if you would like to go and hike this trail, all you need to do is download the tracks and spend about $500 at REI on proper equipment, and then you're good to go hike the Rush Creek Wilderness Trail. Thank you.